This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and Chris Prytower.
Welcome, everyone, to the Financial Sense News Hour. This week, we do a deep dive into a topic that's not on the minds of most investors or consumers: a recession and bear market. We've covered the consensus forecast for the year. Wall Street analysts are bullish on the stock market and the economy. And although you do hear occasional mention of a possible recession should the Fed raise rates too far, it is a minor possibility in the minds of most strategists. We've gotten a reprieve from the government shutdown, the longest in recent memory, but at least for the moment, things are back to normal. So what are the possibilities that we do get a recession or a bear market this year? It would certainly be a surprise to the folks on Wall Street that are extremely bullish at the moment. What we're going to do on this show is take a look at the LEIs, market risks, credit spreads, and an inflating debt bubble, and look at the possibilities. Now, in a recent interview on FS Insider, Jim, you interviewed noted economist A. Gary Schilling, and he mentioned that two of the ingredients of a recession are missing.
There have been two causes of recessions. One is the Fed tightens, are only trying to cool off what they see as an overheated economy. But 12 out of 13 times, by my count, they've gotten a recession. The only soft landing, in effect, was in the mid-90s. And, of course, now the Fed is raising rates, but they're also selling off this huge portfolio they built up with quantitative easing. Now, the Fed has had over a century experience with interest rates as their policy instrument, and they still have, you know, miserable luck in soft landings, and now for the first time ever, they're liquidating this massive portfolio. So you say, hey, the odds sooner or later, the Fed is going to do the usual deed. But having said that, I think that you're probably at least a year away before they get rates high enough to really bite. And of course, now it looks like they're pausing. Interestingly enough, the transcript of their mid-December meeting, they basically said that in view of the fact that inflation was not coming in as expected, they were tempted to pause. So that could take a while before they do it. The other cause, of course, is a financial shock like we had in 2000 when the dot-com stocks collapsed. And then in the mid-2000s, when we had the subprime mortgage collapse. In other words, you had a financial shock that precipitated a recession. But those are the two causes. And right now, I think the Fed's some time away before they do the deed. And I just don't see the financial shocks. And as you know, Jim, I've made a career out of looking for bubbles, and I don't see anything that's significant. The only thing that I can suggest, and this is kind of a sleeper, is that maybe this long economic expansion that started in the middle of 2009, and of course the stock market rally, which was touched off by Fed largesse in March of 2009 and ran almost 10 years, that has created so much complacency, which is a lot more leverage. There's a lot more risk having been taken, that people have moved out further on that risk curve than any of us realize, including the people involved. And if things start to come unglued, we'll see all that come out of the woodwork.
What I want to do today is look at some of these possibilities. We'll get to Gary's views here in a second. He aired that in an interview we did on FS Insider last Friday. He talked about 13 particular indicators that have placed his odds of 2/3 of a recession occurring this year. We'll get to that later on in the program. But, you know, every economic cycle is different. They are driven by debt expansion and, of course, cheap money. And whenever you get into a Fed rate raising cycle, as we are now, the tighter financial conditions expose the financial vulnerabilities that have grown over the last decade as a result of this accommodative monetary policy. You know, just take a look at it. Soaring asset prices from stocks to bonds have lifted household spending. Low interest rates have pushed corporate debt to record levels. Risk-taking is evident everywhere, from credit spreads to loan covenants, and we covered that last week. Now, all of these factors become vulnerable to higher interest rates and liquidity risk as the Fed removes the monetary punch bowl. So the economic and financial conditions you want to monitor are things like credit spreads, the yield curve, the leadership within the stock market, and of course, what we're going to be talking about today, the leading economic indicators.
And I know we monitor a bevy of indicators, Jim. These are indicators that are pretty comprehensive. I want to ask you, for our listeners, What are these indicators telling you now? I mean, in our forecast this month, we highlighted that the economic growth is slowing globally, as well as here in the U.S., but the consensus numbers, they don't seem to be showing signs of a recession.
No, they don't. I mean, if you look at the risk of a recession, there actually is a recession indicator. There's one that Moody's does. We have our own that we do internally. And if you look at what has happened, it has been rising since last summer. Now, when the recession index hit a low for the year, it was 10. I believe that was in June. It has steadily risen to 17. So the odds of a recession in the next 6 months remain pretty low. But here's the catch. If this index keeps rising, we could find ourselves in trouble in the second half of the year. Our own index is pretty similar. And Chris, whenever it starts to get above 20, it is usually led to some kind of major downshift in the economy. Last time it got to 20 was in the summer of 2011. If you remember what was going on at that time, we had Fukushima, we had the Arab oil spring, we had oil prices at $110 a barrel, we had the downgrading of U.S. debt, we had the pig crisis in Europe. All of this was hitting, and the stock market was down 20%. So we could have gone in that direction, but the Fed stepped to the plate. They started what we call QE infinity, and it was up and away again. So what we do know now is the economy is definitely slowing down, both here and abroad. The stimulus that we've been talking about, which was passed last year, that runs out by this September, and we're in the middle of a presidential election cycle, so expect to hear crazy policies and promises from politicians, which is also going to create another level of uncertainty for the markets. For example, the Democrats are talking about major new taxes on companies and individuals, regulation, a massive new spending program from free healthcare, free college, free daycare. And we know this, nothing the government gives you is free. Somewhere, somebody has to pay for that. And there's a new economic doctrine that is catching on among the young, left-leaning politicians. It's called modern monetary theory. The concept behind the theory is that deficits don't matter if you can borrow in your own currency, just as long as it doesn't cause inflation. In other words, spend money and finance it through debt monetization. Now, we tried that in the 70s with Arthur Burns, and it led to a 14% inflation rate. And of course, we have an extreme example of that in Venezuela right now, where the inflation is running 1,000,000%.
Okay, well, that sounds high.
Just a little high. Not quite like Weimar Germany, but it's getting up there. But what we do know now is the risk of recession is rising.
And I want to go into a bit of detail here, Jim, because as I mentioned when we started the show a moment ago, the folks on Wall Street are extremely bullish right now. So let's peel back the onion and dig into this. And I'd like to see if we can discuss oil and how Venezuela may be impacting. We've been talking about oil, you know, week by week, but certainly what's going on there has got to have an impact too. But let's drill down into the specifics.
All right. When you look at economic data, it comes in two varieties. There's hard data, which would be like the ISM manufacturing report, the Fed surveys, industrial production, durable goods, housing starts. We call that hard data. Then there's what we call the soft data, which is sort of what I call the confidence surveys. They're important because they tell you what people are thinking, whether you're a home builder, a consumer, a small business person, or loan officer at a bank. So there's four that we're going to talk about here. One is the Confidence Board's Consumer Confidence Index. It just came out this week. The NFIB Small Business Survey, the NAHB Housing Market, and the Senior Loan Officer Survey. Now let's begin with consumer confidence, which is tightly correlated to what happens in the stock market. Now, it peaked in October. And guess what peaked in October at the same time? You guessed it. It was the stock market, which was at that time at record levels. So as the stock market began falling into negative territory, which is the way we ended up the year, the survey released this week shows further deterioration in consumer confidence. The index has fallen from a peak of 137.9 in October to the recent one reported this week of 120. So that's a drop in 13% in just 3 months. And I would suspect with the government shutdown and market volatility, that trend for consumer confidence will probably end up continuing to decline when we get next month. If it declines enough, the thing I would be watching for, does that translate into retail sales or lower retail sales going forward?
And on our weekend show, Jim, we touched on housing a little bit. I want to go into a little bit of that now. I suspect that housing is down as a result of rising interest rates, which translates into higher mortgages.
Yeah, if we start out with the NAHB Housing Index, it has been trending down since early last summer. It's down about 10 points. Now, home builder sentiment stabilized this month. Now, the housing market has been held back by a number of factors. It's not just interest rates. We've seen supply constraints, limited inventory, a shortage of construction workers. Add to that rising prices and rising mortgage rates, and the affordability index has fallen sharply. So you can see this corroborated in housing starts. Now, let me just go through a few of these with you. New home sales peaked in March of last year and have fallen sharply from 672,000 to 544,000. Pending home sales are down from June at 107 to dropping to 101 in November. Existing home sales peaked in May of last year, falling steadily every single month, and then they just tumbled in December. New residential construction has fallen much. It's doing much better than, let's say, other segments of the housing market, and that is mainly due to multifamily construction. In other words, they're building apartments. So, Chris, as we look at this, overall housing has been on a weakening trend for the last 6 months as mortgage rates have risen along with prices and affordability index has fallen. Now, here's some good news. If you're out there, I don't know, let's say you're a first-time home buyer or you're thinking of trading up, the good news is mortgage rates have fallen from close to 5% down to around 4.25% for a 30-year fixed rate mortgage. Interest rates came down precipitously in the month of December. We went from almost 3.25% on the 10-year treasury, and we're now down to below roughly around 2.7%. So the 10-year has fallen by 0.5%, and we've seen 30-year mortgage rates get down to 4.25%. So that should help stabilize the housing market, but it is on a weakening trend.
And do you think, Jim, that housing is more of a reflection of where you live, or do you think it's the new tax bill, or do you think it's both of those things?
You know, I think it reflects both of those. Obviously, where you live and the size and price of your home you're looking for is definitely a factor in housing. I mean, if you take a look at homes along here, Chris, you're well aware of California. California's definition of a millionaire is a homeowner. I mean, if you take a look at homes along the West Coast, the Northeast, they're obviously more expensive and they're located, another factor, in high-tax states where home buyers have lost most of the tax advantages as a result of that new tax bill, which caps mortgage interest to only $750,000. It used to be $1 million plus $100,000 for a second mortgage. It also capped property tax deductions to $10,000. And it also eliminated the deductibility of state taxes. So those areas of the country tend to be a little bit weaker. We're seeing definitely a strong weakening in the high end of the housing market here in California and also on the East Coast. Now, the final survey relates to small business confidence. Here we have some good news. And also the Senior Loan Officer Survey shows that banks have been easing lending standards for commercial and industrial loans during the third quarter. And small business confidence, though lower, is still high as companies struggle to find skilled and qualified workers.
Well, Jim, let's move on to some other indicators. But before we do so, I want to play another clip from your Schilling interview on the forerunners of a recession.
Well, probably the greatest of those, as we talked earlier, Jim, is the Fed tightening. But again, it's probably some quarters, maybe a year away before they really get tight enough to disrupt the economy. But, you know, it could be a combination. I've described it as death by a thousand cuts. But again, it's a difficult recession call because you just don't have one of those two standard precipitators, Fed rates high enough to kill the economy or a financial shock.
Now, it's interesting. Schilling is one of the few economists I have found that gives a high probability of a recession occurring this year. Now, according to his latest Insight newsletter, which is an excellent newsletter, by the way, his 2019 outlook, he lists 13 factors that are indicators showing that there's a high probability of a recession. Now, Schilling is no stranger to calling it the way it is. As he mentioned in that interview, he was probably the only guy to get fired by Don Regan, the former Secretary of the Treasury, under President Reagan. He was fired once at Merrill Lynch for predicting the 71 recession, and then he goes to White Weld. Merrill Lynch buys White Weld. He predicts another recession, gets fired again. So he's got a good, pretty good track record. But he has 13 indicators, and I just want to touch on them for a moment. Number one, output exceeds capacity, stocks falling, central banks are tightening, as he mentioned in that clip there. The yield curve inversion is near, and we're going to talk about that here shortly. Junk bond treasury yield spreads are starting to open up. Housing activity is declining. Corporate growth is beginning to fall. Consumers are optimistic, no kidding. Global leading indicators are dropping. Commodity prices decline. Take a look at oil. Downward data revisions, emerging market troubles mount, and the U.S.-China trade war escalates. So those are 30 indicators, or 13 indicators. And as Schilling talked about, he said here, we put the odds of a U.S. recession that could be global this year at about two-thirds. The other third would be economic slowing, but no sustained decline. So he's got the odds of a recession at two-thirds.
Now, again, on our weekend show, we touched just a bit on LEIs, but what about the rest of your LEIs as it relates to this topic here, Jim, the hard data?
Well, we have about 15 that we follow. I'm not going to get into every one of them. I want to touch upon some of the main ones because we just don't have the time. And the main ones are the ISM and the Regional Fed Survey. So let's start with the ISM Manufacturing and Non-Manufacturing Survey. Both surveys peaked in September of last year, 61.3 for manufacturing and 61.6 for non-manufacturing. Now, we saw a steep drop-off in manufacturing in December when the index fell to 54.1. New orders also dropped off sharply. So this kind of lines up with regional Fed manufacturing surveys, which are also softening. Now, on the service side of the economy, it held up much better, but it too is softening. Both surveys, manufacturing at 54.1 and non-manufacturing at 57.6, are still comfortably above 50. It's when you get down to 50 or below that there's trouble on the way. So both are still in what we would call an expansionary mode, but they're slowing. So you now have three sectors of the economy that are weakening: housing, manufacturing, and services. So the economic numbers you're going to see reported are going to surprise to the downside going forward. And that is why you see the market on shaky ground here. A lot of times when you'll see the market's down 300 points or 400 points for the day, you'll find often cited some kind of economic report either here or globally that points to a slowdown. It's actually worse overseas. But the one thing that's happening right now is a globalized, synchronized slowdown. So it's not just the U.S. It's global. It's Germany, Italy, Europe, and a major slowdown in China and Japan. And if we look at all the regional Fed surveys, they all point to a slowdown from California to New York, the Midwest to Texas to Richmond. I think this is probably one reason, Chris, you have seen the Fed take maybe a softer tone since the beginning of the year. You contrast what the Fed's saying now in January, compare that to what they were saying going back to the December FOMC meeting. So they have to be looking at this data, and it should give them some reason to pause, which they're doing. It's probably one reason why the futures market is predicting. In some ways, the Fed has already done raising rates for this rate cycle, but that can still change, as it's still too early to call this one.
Well, and that's why I asked if we could go over those LEIs, Jim. It's just so useful in getting an idea of where we're headed.
You know, it was one reason we saw the Fed pivot this week at the FOMC meeting.
The U.S. economy is in a good place, and we will continue to use our monetary policy tools to help keep it there. The jobs picture continues to be strong, with the unemployment rate near historic lows and with stronger wage gains. Inflation remains near our 2% goal. We continue to expect that the American economy will grow at a solid pace in 2019, although likely slower than the very strong pace of 2018. We believe that our current policy stance is appropriate at this time. Despite this positive outlook, over the past few months, we have seen some cross currents and conflicting signals about the outlook. Growth has slowed in some major foreign economies, particularly China and Europe. There is elevated uncertainty around several unresolved government policy issues, including Brexit, ongoing trade negotiations, and the effects from the partial government shutdown in the United States. Financial conditions tightened considerably late in 2018 and remain less supportive of growth than they were earlier in 2018. And while most of the incoming domestic economic data have been solid, some surveys of business and consumer sentiment have moved lower, giving reason for caution. In this environment, we believe we can best support the economy by being patient in evaluating the outlook before making any future adjustment to policy.
In the meeting, they seem to indicate they're done raising for now. At least that's the way the market's interpreting. And that, if you look at it, is almost a complete about face from just 6 weeks ago. Now, Powell acknowledged growing risk of a sharp U.S. economic slowdown. We got some GDP numbers that look like the economy only grew at a 2.6% growth rate. And he also cited other factors. And this is probably good because it's the first time the Fed is acknowledging, hey, it's not just happening here. There's problems overseas. He cited Europe and Asia, and especially China. He also cited that financial conditions have tightened. No kidding. You're shrinking your balance sheet by $50 billion a month. Powell mentioned other uncertainties as a result of, for example, the partial government shutdown, which we know will impact Q1 of this year. He cited Brexit and trade. Now, what the markets liked the best was that the Fed's balance sheet may stay larger than expected, indicating the Fed was rethinking QT. Now, remember, if you go back to December, one of the things the markets didn't like and caused that steep sell-off all the way up to the day before Christmas was when a reporter asked him on QT, and he said it was on automatic pilot. He seemed to be walking that back this week. Now, right now, the futures markets have a 4% probability of a rate hike in June. That's down substantially. A 6% probability that rates would be higher 1 year from now. And check this out, a 22% probability that rates could actually be lower this time next year. Now, the market seemed to like what they heard with big gains in the Dow Industrials and the S&P. And of course, the dollar is falling, as Mark Chandler and I talked about in hour one, and we're also seeing gold break out. However, don't get your happy feet on yet. My own belief is that this is temporary. Don't count the Fed out just yet. This can all change if oil prices keep rising, as I expect, or the economy picks up in Q2.
But if I were to summarize here all the economic data that you look at, both here and globally, it seems to point to a synchronized global slowdown, which is taking place. And this raises the question about why they're still considering raising their interest rates and shrinking their balance sheet. And that's a question that you asked Gary Schilling.
The Fed has been driven, at least until recently with the current chairman, Jerome Powell, has been driven by academic economists. Janet Yellen, certainly in that camp, and before her, Ben Bernanke. And they have been imbued, saturated, convinced, the so-called Phillips curve, which basically says that if you've got low unemployment, you're going to have high inflation. Now, that hasn't happened. Inflation rates have really gone nowhere in this whole expansion, yet the unemployment rate, the headline rate, has gone from 10% now to 3.9%. So it just hasn't worked. Well, what they have said, the Fed, and this is still much, I think, the view of the staff, is that this is, you just wait, it's coming, you know, it's just delayed. Well, you know, delay, it just doesn't happen. And they have not been willing to say, wait a minute, maybe we're just wrong. Maybe this thing isn't working. And we've discussed a number of reasons why it isn't working. I mean, you look at things like globalization, probably the biggest development on the global economic scene in the last three decades, transfer of manufacturing, other high-paid jobs from North America and Europe to China and other countries. A lot of deflationary forces there. You look at Uber, you look at Amazon, all these things that are very, very deflationary. And you simply haven't had that. And the Fed has been, they've had their needle stuck on this Phillips curve. Now Powell is not a PhD economist. Now, I say that as one, but I'm happy that we've got somebody at the helm there who is not a PhD economist, because I think he's much more pragmatic. He's much more willing to look at the data as opposed to economic theory and keep saying it's got to work, even though it isn't working. And maybe that's got to do with his with the recent, you know, so-called pause in the Fed, their statement, I mentioned the minutes of the mid-December meeting. But at the same time, if you look back the transcripts, you know, there's the announcement right after the Fed meetings, the Federal Open Market Committee, their policy meeting. That's immediately after the meeting. And then a week or so later, there's the minutes, about 2 or 3 weeks. And that's what we just got for the mid-December. And then 5 years later, the transcript, in other words, who said what. And if you look back, they just released that for 2013. And Powell was very hawkish. He was constantly harping on Bernanke, then the chairman, that they really had to cut back on the quantitative easing, that that was going to be difficult to get rid of because they pumped out so much money. So he at least comes into this with a somewhat hawkish view.
So Jim, you'd think that with economies here and overseas softening, that this would be the logical place to stop.
No, not so fast, Grasshopper. If you look at Powell, in the past he was a hawk during, as Gary was talking about, during the Bernanke and Yellen era. So I guess the question is, has he had a change in his thinking? You know, quite honestly, at this time, we don't know. Last fall, he was sounding very hawkish, even as far as recent as the December FOMC meeting, which sent the markets from record highs to a tailspin in losses for the year. I think, Chris, if we looked at 2018, if you looked at everything that we had going last year, the $1.5 trillion tax stimulus, the cutting of corporate tax rates, we saw the economy lift up into the 4% range, corporate profits were growing at 25% a quarter. I don't think with all of that taking place, you would have believed that we would ended up, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8% down for the year, with many of the stocks within the indexes down as much as 20%. So, you know, a lot of that, once again, came with the Fed in their September meeting, which said they were far from neutral, in December saying we have no plan to cut back on QT. So unfortunately, when it comes to the Fed, they have a terrible track record in engineering a soft landing. They've only done it once in my career, which was 1994. So if they stopped now, that would be a possibility. But I just don't think they will unless economic conditions either continue to worsen. And even if they do and they stop, by the time they do it, it would probably be too late. So right now, we have $180 billion of incremental fiscal stimulus, and that should help us, at least in the first half of the year. But that money runs out by September. And I guess the question is, what happens then?
Well, as we talked about in earlier shows, Jim, there is plenty out there to worry about, from a slowing Chinese economy, a slowing down in Europe and Asia, and, as headlines today show, a messy Brexit. But as you and others have discussed, there isn't a financial shock as of yet. But I thought you might have identified one of those shocks in last week's show on the approaching debt tsunami.
That's the one issue that worries us more than anything else than the economic data we are following are what we call financial excesses that have grown as a result of accommodative monetary policy over the last decade. Let's face it, when you take interest rates down to zero, if you are retired, looking for income, you're a pension fund that is required to earn maybe 6-7% to make your pension or pay out your pension benefits, everybody has been searching around the globe. I don't care, anywhere, under every nook and cranny, looking for higher yields. And this includes the stretch market valuations that we've seen historically on, for example, non-financial debt. We talked last week about removing all the safety covenants. And so, you know, I'm going to be writing more on that because we got a lot of response to last week's show, and I will be covering that in future articles I'm writing. And it's amazing, Chris, I've been doing a study of debt cycles, and they go all the way back to ancient Rome. Believe it or not, quantitative easing? Well, we got a glimpse of it in 33 AD with the Emperor Tiberius, and I'll be writing about that in an upcoming article. So the one thing, as Gary talked about, what we have not seen at this point is a financial shock. And as I look at the corporate debt market, that's where I expect it to originate.
Well, let me come back to the confidence surveys that we just discussed. I mean, obviously, when the stock market goes up for an extended period of time, well, consumers feel more confident. The job market is the best it's been in over four decades. And when your 401k and your stock portfolio is going up, the average person feels wealthier. They have the propensity to spend. What about the downside, though, when things reverse and instead of going up, you begin losing money? That just can't be good on your psyche. Hey, honey, our portfolio's down 40%. Let's go to the mall and spend a bunch of money.
No, there's a direct correlation with what economists call the wealth effect, but in reverse on the downside. It is a coincidence that the market turmoil in the downturn that we saw in Q4 led to a drop in consumer confidence. Now, consumers are willing to spend more money when their equity portfolios, as you mentioned, are going up. And also, Chris, another important one is the value of their homes increase, which both have been doing as of late. In fact, there is a graph that we have on Bloomberg that traces personal spending with increases in the stock market and housing. There's a high correlation between the two, with consumer spending rising and falling with asset prices. And as we saw plunges in spending, for example, during the dot-com bust or the housing crisis, both were preceded by Fed rate hikes. So right now, consumers are still in a good mood. Housing prices have been slowing, but they're still going up year over year. We got a report this week. The CoreLogic Case-Shiller Home Price Index shows housing prices are up 4.7% year over year. Given the healthy job market and still rising home prices, you know what? Consumers are still spending. Every time I go to the mall, they're always busy. You have to drive around trying to find, I call it my parking lot indicator. And definitely that was something that really alerted me that something was going on in the economy in 2007 and 2008. It was easier to get a parking spot. So at least right now, given a surprise shock to the stock market like we got in February of last year, the first half is looking pretty good. It's the second half of the year. That's another story, as the stimulus will be exhausted by the end of September, and we're going to be full swing in a presidential election cycle with different agendas for both parties. And here's the thing. Markets, I don't care if it's the president tweeting or let's say somebody running for office that proposes something that's sort of a radical change, markets hate uncertainty, and election cycles are full of them. Right now, there's a high degree of complacency among investors and consumers that the good times will last forever. They never do.
Well, and I know in your interview with Gary Shilling, even recently with Louis Gov and Russell Napier, they all express some reservation and caution about corporate risk. And this is where you think that if there is a financial shock, it'll erupt in the corporate area, especially if the economy turns down.
Yeah, I mean, if we take a look at the financial crisis, as we have pointed out, leverage has increased. And if you look at what we kind of look at, which are key ratios, and that's EBITDA, that is earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. They have increased substantially. It's now close to 2x versus 1x back in 2011. It is also near the upper end of a 30-year range. And it even actually looks worse if you back out the cash-rich companies like Apple, Alphabet, Google, Microsoft, Berkshire Hathaway, and many of the drug companies. That ratio actually goes to 2.5. And this ratio can remain high for years before it becomes a problem. But that problem is getting closer as the Fed keeps hiking interest rates, because all that debt on balance sheets that has to be rolled over gets to be more expensive. Now, we covered last week the BBB bond issue. It is still lurking out there and could come undone if the economy weakens further or as the Fed keeps raising interest rates. Now, what worries me the most is that credit spreads have been rising lately but are rather muted given the degree of risk in the corporate debt markets. Investors are still chasing yields and are getting very little in the way of interest to compensate them for that risk.
Now, what about the yield curve? A number of experts that we've had on the program have made reference to that indicator that it is a harbinger of future economic problems and maybe even recession.
Yeah, currently, if we take a look at the 10-year note is roughly around 2.7 and the 2-year note is around 2.57. Now, that's a spread of 14 basis points between the two. So what we're seeing is the yield curve is beginning to flatten. Now, historically, the beginning of a recession in an inverted yield curve is ranged between, let's say, 12 and 22 months. But here's the point. Every recession of the last 60 years has been preceded by an inverted yield curve. Now, if we zero in on this difference between yields, between the 2s and 10s, the curve gets down to 12 basis points. The probability of a recession occurring over the next 12 to 18 months rises to 50%. When that spread narrows to 10 basis points, The odds, check this out, jumped to 90%. We are now at only 14 basis points, 4 basis points away from a 90% probability or a 50% probability of a recession. So unless the Fed throttles back, stops QT, we are most definitely heading for a recession, and along with it, an accompanying bear market, if we aren't already in one.
Well, let's sum up here. We talked about LEIs. They're heading south, pointing to a slowing economy. Economic growth has shifted globally. We're now in a synchronized economic slowdown. The Fed has said that it will remain on pause here, but they've not backed off from the possibility of future rate hikes down the road, maybe in June and in December. Debt levels are at dangerously high levels in the corporate debt markets, and stock prices still remain elevated despite recent corrections. There are no financial shocks at this time, but there are distinct possibilities in the corporate debt markets. So it is a time to be cautious. And Jim, what are you doing for your clients, if I may ask?
You know, Chris, we are definitely positioned defensively for our clients. You know, each account varies because according to investment objectives. But I mean, we're holding cash. We're holding treasuries, short-term, high-quality corporate debt. And quite honestly, we just aren't chasing stocks at these levels as we expect a market pullback to occur before investing any further. Now, a couple of areas that we're looking at, we're kind of on the value side, so we like to look at things that get beat up pretty badly. So we're monitoring emerging markets and debt as this market has been beaten up rather substantially. And we're also looking at gold, given the fact we expect the dollar could be close to a peak and may peak if the Fed dials back. But to sum it up, we remain defensive as we believe there is just too much risk out there.
Well, if listeners would like to contact your Financial Sense advisory team, Jim, how can they do so?
They can call us, Chris, at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. And we'd be glad to offer them a free risk assessment. We have very sophisticated software. They analyze risk levels of actual mutual funds, ETFs, and individual bonds and equities. And that's really, I think, important at this stage, depending on where you are in life. If you are 50 and close to 60, close to retirement, or you just retired, you really need to take a look at the risk levels you're sitting on. And more importantly, if you're in bond ETFs or bond ETFs, you better know what they're sitting on. Are they sitting on those triple Bs and those junk bonds or those illiquid bonds? That's a question you need to be asking yourself, because when this thing does unravel, I don't think that's going to end in a good way.
So, Jim, what do you see coming up in the weeks ahead?
Well, Chris, in the weeks ahead, we got a couple of things going on. Next week, we should have the State of the Union speech. We also have some key earnings reports. We're working our way through fourth quarter earnings season. We've had some misses, and we've had some that have beat expectations on the technology side. We also have the debt ceiling debate. Well, we just got done with the government shutdown, but we're going to have to extend the debt ceiling. It is now close to $22 trillion. So earnings, the Fed meeting coming up in March, and of course, we have politics as usual. All of that, we'll be here to talk about it and monitor it. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Prytower and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.